Well, thanks for bearing with the technological snafu, and we'll have some, we just have 5 minutes for questions and answers, or we also know that there are people here who, other than the speakers, who have experience that is relevant to the topics that we've just discussed. So we welcome you to, well, I see people stacking up at the microphone, so we'll just go right ahead and take the first question, comment.
Thank you. Actually, I don't have a question, just a couple of comments that I think you might be interested in. I'm Miles Ellis with the Canadian Teachers Federation, and with regards to your information on the Aboriginal situation, at the Canadian Teachers Federation, we have an Aboriginal Education Standing Committee, and for the last 2 years, we've been working with the CCL and Canadian Council on Learning, and they've, with us, they provided significant funding. And we have what we believe will be considered groundbreaking research and report coming from Verna St. Denis out of the University of Saskatchewan, Aboriginal professor there. And what she did was that she organized and attended with us focus groups of Aboriginal educators all across Canada in every province and territory except for Quebec, and focus groups with teachers who either had all Aboriginal children in their classes or at least some. And her report is on what are the promising and best practices of those educators and what they recommend for success if we're going to have better success for Aboriginal children. So watch for that. My email is in your package, so if anyone have an interest with that, you can contact me. The second thing I will say is that with regards to boys and the challenges that you're seeing, just to give you a Canadian context with your excellent information, is that in an analysis of the 2001-2006 data from Census Stats Canada, is that there is a significant increase in the number of boys being identified as having special needs. And just to show you the difference with girls and boys, in the 15 to 24 age group, boys and girls that have identified with disability, they're about the same, 4.7 to 4.8% of the population. But when you go to the age 5 to 14 age group, is that the boys, 5.7 to girls, 3.4, it's approaching 2 to 1. And in the age 0 to 4 age group, it's 2.1 to 1.2, almost 2 to 1 again. What I've been told by researchers involved with special education is that there appears to be, obviously, and teachers have said this for the last generation, that there's been a significant increase in the number of children identified in coming into the classrooms in Canada identified with special educational needs. And the researcher I was talking to posited three scenarios as to why that's the case, in their opinion. One was the breakdown of the nuclear family. And you talked, some of you talked earlier, about the high degree of single-member families, usually women, who are raising students with special needs. Second was the environmental impact in recent years with chemicals in the environment. The third was, and this is something we can all think about in this room, the third was what they called the harvest of the drug and alcohol culture from the 70s. So I'll leave you to think about that one.
Thank you very much. Yes, go ahead, please.
John Lundy from Laurentian University in Sudbury, Ontario. This is sort of a comment to you, Jessica, but really to the rest of the panel, I suppose. Comment, maybe there's a question you hear somewhere. This has to do with one of the themes in the conference so far, which has been the importance of quality data and the social use of data. And what I found interesting in your comments about the 40 to 50% of Aboriginals who are on reserve in a rural remote is the flip side of that. And the flip side, of course, is that 50 to 60% are in urban settings. So, for example, if we go to StatsCan's ESTAT program, we can see that in Scarborough, there are more Aboriginals in Scarborough, which is a suburb of Toronto, than there are in Nipissing District or in Sudbury District. What's the importance of this? Well, the importance, I think, of this particular data is that teacher education institutions should be talking about and celebrating Aboriginal issues and content. That's the first thing. So in other words, all teacher educators should be focused on that. And I just want to say a thank you to Ratna Ghosh. I saw Ratna. I'm not sure if she's here right now. But I want to thank Ratna Ghosh for influencing me. We've put up a school of education in Sudbury that imbues all coursework with Aboriginal issues and content. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say. And so it's important to look at the urban aspect. The urban aspect in Canada is going to make quite a difference because you don't have necessarily one First Nation. Yeah, as a matter of fact, you have many First Nations and you have many different Aboriginal groups, which adds to the complexity of it. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to just sort of make that comment. I'm not sure what else to go from there. Maybe you can comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. These things are always so much more complex than we can convey in a short presentation. Yes.
Passing reference has been made to the link between school functionality and the functionality of the family. The question, for example, of single parenthood, parents involving an illness, drunkenness, crime, lack of education, etc., etc. And so my question really is, has there been studies showing that as you improve family functionality, whatever the cause is, that there is an improvement in attendance and in functioning at the primary school level? In other words, if you help the family in general, does that carry over to school? Is really my question.
It's sort of an interesting question and relates to the previous speaker. We do know that if you think about education as education for all instead of education for particular groups, and that we stop concentrating on, for example, kids with disabilities and special education and concentrate on education where we have pedagogical theories in which people can be treated as individuals within the classroom, we see a big change. In terms of some of the work that's been done, you can see that if families are engaged in the education, then you'll have better success rates.
That's not my question. My question is, if you help the family, not whether the family gets involved, but if you help the family that has problems, is there a spin-off effect on the education?
Well, I'll leave that to my colleagues.
I can't cite you a study off the top of my head, but definitely in the U.S., Early Start, Head Start, the parent involvement programs have been shown to be beneficial to the outcomes for children.
No, but you're talking about work done with the children.
No, with the families of the children.
Okay.
Head Start has a very strong family component. Families are brought into the school and are given training around issues of child development and are often brought in to the classroom as helpers. There's Early Start, there's programs where people trained in early childhood go into the home and work with the parent and child. The HIPPE program is one. The Head Start also has an in-home parent training program. These programs have been shown to be effective. They bring parents into the educational process with their children, beginning at the early childhood level and in the home, as well as bringing them into the classroom
in the
Head Start program.
I think that, you know, that's a very, very interesting topic that we'll obviously have to have a lot more conversation about. It's a good conversation starter. Thank you. We just have 2 more minutes and 2 people standing at the mic, so.
My question is very short. I've just got a question for Merle and Barbara. When you're talking about the boys and the different characteristics and the statistics, I was wondering if there are any significant differences between rural and urban populations. I guess there's a different demographic there as well. And if it's, I mean, you mentioned something about the risk among populations of African American Latino boys being the highest. If there's any significant differences between the rural and urban?
Well, I'd have to say that I don't know that if the research has divided it that way, but in our focus groups, we talked to parents from both rural and urban areas, and their concerns and their sort of strategies were exactly the same, and that the boys were the boys' issues were the same in them. That was a very small sample, I grant you, but there really were no differences. Except the one difference was that the urban parents said that their sons might be more likely to engage in sort of street behavior, risky street behavior, and end up in jail. And that wasn't sort of the reference for the rural parents, but the sort of consequences, were the same.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. I have a question for Marcia. Sorry, Marcia. You mentioned, you made a good, very good point at the beginning of your presentation about how educational systems don't exist on their own. They're obviously in a context which include economic, political, social factors. And then in your program that you conducted with CEDA, you talked about how parents were invited to give their feedback on what they wanted for their children's education, and you identified three of those requests. I was wondering if parents were also invited to discuss some of the challenges they face in terms of the other factors, which would then either prevent or encourage their children to learn and to benefit from education.
Yes. Yeah, we did, actually. We had groups of parents, mostly mothers. I have to admit, the fathers were somewhat absent. Not that they were absent, but they didn't see education as being particularly their bailiwick, so it tended to be the mothers. But they certainly, we had a lot of groups before we started the schools to ask people what they wanted, how they saw it could be effective, all of those kinds of questions. So we had a lot of discussion around, number one, what they wanted to see, so that we could measure what we were doing against what they said they wanted, not simply a kind of random external evaluation. We wanted to measure what they said they wanted to have happen. So we did do that, and we looked at the issues they have around school. It was very interesting because, by and large, they wanted to send their girls to school, not the boys. Now, in these areas we were working in, very young boys are actually already working. They do a lot of beading work. They do a lot of micro-industry kind of thing because every house has a little shop in it. So I think to send the boys to school was actually going to be problematic because they needed them as part of the income earners right from the time they're about 5 years old. They have little fingers that can do a lot of stuff that nobody else can do. So we did talk about that. I mean, people concentrate on interesting things. One of the issues that the mothers felt they really had was around hygiene, because it's kind of filthy in the slum, and so mothers really felt that for the kids to move forward, they needed to have some idea about hygiene. They needed to have some idea around speaking English. They knew it was difficult to get their kids to school, so they'd rally the whole family to make sure the kid got there. So they saw that as really important, but there were all kinds of those. They went off to the village when the rains came. They left and went to the villages. So they said, we're not going to be at school during the rains because we go back to our village during the rains. So all of those were kind of built in trying to understand an ecological perspective.
So I hope you'll join me in thanking Jessica for moderating this, for thanking Marcia, Merle, Barbara, and Marlene, for really getting us deep into this notion about how gender, race, ethnicity, disability, how all of these intersect with each other. So please join me. And then I have a couple quick logistical announcements, but first, I do want to say a special thanks to Marlene for her persistence when we were having difficulty with the plug-in, and to all of you for your patience. There is one other gender-related thing I have to announce now that we're at lunch. There's a history of inequalities in education at all levels. That includes at McGill. Mm-hmm. The faculty club used to be all male. For those women who are looking for the restroom, that's why on the ground floor you will only find one that's handicap accessible. The one with which is larger is upstairs. Please feel free to go upstairs. So right now we're going to have lunch. We're take about the half an hour until 1 o'clock to get your lunch, to sit, to talk to each other, and then during lunch we're going to hear about two truly extraordinary programs that began on opposite sides of the world. So join us back here at 1 and enjoy till then.